Well, I reckon there's a couple of certainties in life, and one is that when you've had a massive breakup, you just need to go on an epic journey and travel, just get out of your own area. And the other truism, it seems that whenever you're about to go overseas on an epic trip, or you're in the middle of the one you're about to move on, that's when you'll meet someone that you fall madly, madly in love with. And you don't know if you love them because you're going and it can't last, or if it's the real deal. Has that happened to you? Well, Sheridan Jobbins actually did both these things. She's a name probably familiar to you. She's kind of like TV royalty. Sheridan's a third generation filmmaker. She was the youngest person ever to have her own TV show in Cooking with Sherry when she was young. She went on to present on Simon Townsend's Wonderworld. And she's also been a director of the film company which produced Priscilla Queen of the Desert, and she's co-written screenplays including Easy Virtue. So you've seen her work somewhere. Well, some years ago, as her marriage was ending, she smashed all her plates at 4 a.m. and ran away to do her own cinematic epic Thelma Without Louise, like road trip across America. Her baggage in the car was a broken heart and a bit of a fearful temper. And it's all in a book called Wish You Were Here. And she's here with us tonight to tell us all about it. Welcome to the show.
Hey, hi there.
Now, this was a bit of a time ago you did this, but you've been living overseas, so you've come back to release it, which is great. What do you think it is about a breakup that makes us just want to run away from home?
I think once you've tried to make it work, and look, there's something about being empty that is both a blessing and a curse. Like, you just, once you're spent, the idea of trying to fill yourself up with something can be a powerful influence. So on one hand, it's the desire just to live and to make it happen. And the other one is infinite possibilities. Like, if you see emptiness as nothingness, then that's kind of just dour. And once you've been in that space for a while, which I was for about 18 months before the crockery incident, crockery nacht, there's the tabula rasa, the idea of what did you wanted to be. And for me, the moment of having smashed all these plates while trying to be terribly grown up, and to give me some credit, they were all chipped and cracked and broken.
Oh,
and ugly,
yeah.
And, you
know. Come on. The Greeks do it all the time. Don't worry about it.
And fantastic. Have you ever done that with the Greek plates?
I've been at a Greek Easter actually I think I was on Corfu one Easter, right. And I was down the bottom and there was just crockery flying everywhere.
It's spectacular. So for me, the end of that moment was that I'd done it in a block of flats and that my neighbour had come in and said, are you all right? And it was like 4 o'clock in the morning. And it's in that moment of both compassion and kindness and restful stupidity, having kind of spent a lot of energy and realized I couldn't fix the broken thing, which at that time was my marriage. The word that went through my head was America. And it, for me as a kid growing up in Australia, it had been the focus of my television. It was sitcoms with happy endings. It was diners and people who were friends, and, you know, it was cartoons and a future that was atomic and space. It was all the good things.
The land
were
of
there.
Possibility. Yeah. And the time when you were happy and things were simple.
Yes.
Because when you're ending a marriage, nothing's simple and you feel.
Yeah. And also the possibilities of a future that were bright and, you know, optimistic. So, you know, in a very short order, I decided that's what I'd do. And my mother tried to talk me out of it. But she used as a weapon a very poor choice, which is a girlfriend of mine, a mutual girlfriend, who loves adventure. You know, she's the buddy that you go skinny dipping with or whatever it is that you want to do. She'll say yes. So she turned around from saying, you know, this is a dangerous folly, to, yeah, I'm in. And she put up the money for the car. So
you need friends like those.
Yeah, you really do.
Is your mum still cross at her?
Ah, no, I think she's forgiven her now. I think it's all turned out all right.
It did. So you went off to LA and you bought yourself with this money a 1989 Chevy.
Yeah, a Chevy Camaro.
And what do they look like?
Well, they're favoured in certain quarters for drive-by shootings, basically.
Oh, nice.
It's about it's about 3.5 metres. I think if 3.5 metres is about 10, 12 feet, it's a whopping great low-slung, on this occasion, bright red car. And when I went looking for it, I thought I'd get like a Mercedes. So, you know, a good country car in Australia, you know, take out the back seats, put a few sheep in. That's where my mind was. I'd get an old Merc. Only in LA, an old Merc is an old Mercury, a car I'm not familiar with, but It's apparently like trying to get an old Hyundai or Daihatsu. It's like, so they were showing me Camaros and Hondas and all these little tiptoe cars. And I was thinking, this isn't the adventure. This isn't the spacecraft. This isn't the flying shark. And there was a sale on at a place called Sheridan Motors, which, so my name was flashing by me. And when I went in, I laughed so hard at this car. It was just improbable. Six cylinders, much stronger than I was used to. It wasn't going to be reliable in any way, but it was just a joy. And so I bought it and I haggled them down, and that in itself was, you know, a bit of a, doing 6 hours with used car salesmen in LA was, you know, is something, you know, tick that off the bucket
list. And you were not feeling particularly strong, like,
It builds you up. You kind of go, I'm going to say no, and I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say,
I mean, you're a person who's, you know, been in TV and cinema a lot in your life. Were you kind of, did you have your image of yourself as being, you know, something from a movie of driving across America in like the convertible or the Chevy or something?
Yeah.
You know, it's hard not to have those pictures in your head, isn't it?
It is. And I don't know if you've seen it recently, but Thelma and Louise is a stand-up film.
It's one of my favorite films ever.
It works really well. So I guess that is part of it, you know, is the idea of being a runaway is part of it. But there was a moment leaving LA. I nicknamed that car Betty, by the way. She just looked like the biggest penis you've ever seen. I mean, it was such a muscle car. And I couldn't control her without softening her in some way. So, like, for me, she became this, I'd bought her from a man who I'd met who was a Latino. I thought she's like this big Latina lady who, you know, I was going to have a good time and she was going to show me how to have it. And that way we were compadres on the road. So I, you know, this story. And as we were leaving LA, it was on sunset. The colors were all lifting off the sky and it was really like being in Australia. It was that wide open, landscape. It was orange and aqua and blue and into cerulean and the warm breeze coming through the window. And it is a moment for me of absolute perfect happiness. It's like I have no responsibility except to my own happiness. The car is working. The road is safe. And it's a moment that's frozen with other perfect moments of living in the now, of living a dream, of meeting your expectations of being an adult. And that was certainly something I'd always wanted to do, to be that air-conditioned gypsy. And I loved it. So, So I've forgotten the question other than do it if you've got a dream.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that's the thing about travel. You have those moments that are those perfect moments where you're driving off into the sunset, but you also have these moments which are just, when the car doesn't go well and you ended up, basically broken down for a couple of days, not too long into your trip.
No, but real
life. It's highs and lows, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And also, maybe it was this journey that started it, but I think most adventures start with, this went wrong, and that's when the adventure started.
Yeah.
Like, the difference between journeying and travel, between tourism and adventure, is just really something going wrong. So maybe what should have gone wrong was the breakdown of the marriage, but the car was an LA road car. She had way too many miles on her for this particular journey, but also she wasn't meant to do cross country. So about 2 days in, it turned out it was an air intake filter, but at the time it was just like she was just wheezing, first of all in first and then in second and finally in third gear. And I limped into about 5 o'clock on a Saturday, I limped into a place called Tuba City, which is a fairly large largish town.
Because that's always when things go wrong with a car.
Oh, it's like nothing you can do.
On a Saturday when no one can help you.
And I don't, I did actually have what the AAA, which is the American Automobile Association. But even I was in the middle of nowhere. I was outside of the Grand Canyon. And, so we putted into this, this town, and it was part of the Navajo Nation. So it was on an Indian reservation. And, I rang the man. There was a number for after hours and he said he'd be in on Monday. And by now my fury was just starting to bubble, and it was, the thing that was that I had felt stuck, I felt that I'd made this decision to be free and to open road, and I'd had this great moment on the road and then just stopped again. And it was like, why are you making me stop? I don't want to stop. So, you know, my behavior was appalling. I was fortunately given the opportunity to apologize, but nothing was going to happen. So I got a motel room and I stopped. And the next morning I thought, well, I'm here for 2 days. I'll get somebody to show me around. And so I asked if somebody would, and it was like I was asking for a wetsuit. It was just a really weird request to them. So I started to say, you know, if I, $10, $15, would somebody drive me around, you know, I don't know, a taxi or a friend. Finally, somebody suggested I ring the police. And part of me just went, oh, stupid idea. So I rang the police. And I could hear like an incident over their squawk box. I could hear something, and it was. I was thinking, what am I doing? This is so rude.
They've got a murder, and you're asking for a tour guide.
And now I was offering $75. And also, even when I said it, I was thinking I'd gone up in like some auction. You know, I'd been going up, and if that was the problem, but I ended up spending an afternoon with the most remarkable young policeman and his son. And we just got on so well. His father had died quite recently. I was heartbroken. He was showing me how the land worked, and we told the stories of our fathers and our parents and where we were from. And it's back to that great can-do land. I mean, Americans are so generous and so welcoming and helpful and kind and supportive. And we just hit it off, had a really, really tremendous experience. And his dad had been a tracker and he'd learnt some tracking. And so I ran off and he was sort of telling me how much I weighed and that I had a blister in my shoe and I'd broken my arm.
That was freaky. He could tell from your footprints.
Yeah.
All these things about you.
Yeah. And really sweet. Whatever the weight was, he said, that dress is unflattering, which I thought was really cute. That I was lighter than I appeared. But, and even at the end of the day, we'd had a really pleasant afternoon. I really enjoyed it. And he came back and gave me the money back, which I thought was extremely generous.
Lovely. You did meet some fantastic people.
Yeah.
Sheridan Jobbins is with us on Nightlife. She's telling us about her journey across America called Wish You Were Here, where she sets out, when she says we, she means her and her car, Betty, the 1989 Chevy. And, yes, you meet some terrific people along the way, but I did not know that Route 66, it's like this fantasy, I'm going to go on Route 66, you know, I'm going to be Sir Jack Kerouac or whatever it is. It's been decommissioned.
Not only decommissioned, it never went all the way. That was the bit that shocked
me. It's a lie, this whole thing we've been told.
Yeah. So I looked into it and I did all my maths based on it existing. And it was decommissioned in like 1985, like not even recently. And little bits of it have been restored or repaired or they've, you know, but it finished in Chicago. It never went the whole way anyway.
Right.
So my sort of daily ration of miles was, you know, several hundred out as well. I mean, I spent most of the time lost.
You got really very lost. Yeah. So you can't get your kicks. You can get your key on Route 60, not quite six. The fantasies of travel versus the realities. Yeah. That was just another one you encountered.
I like the idea too. You get your key on Route 66 and like what was missing were the half the K's.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. So you did travel across and I mean, I must say the Grand Canyon, I've never been to the Grand Canyon. I'm dying to drive from say LA to the Grand Canyon. Well, I'd love to do what you've done. But, was it at this point that, you know, Al Gore sprung you swimming in your knickers?
I saw Al Gore in my underwear. Take those off, young man. That was actually on the return journey.
That was on your way back. Yeah. All I could remember is Grand Canyon and now I associate it with Al Gore and you swimming half nude.
That was really weird though. In the middle of the trip, I ended up with another travel companion. So my girlfriend paid for half the car and as it turned out, didn't make the return
journey.
Yes,
we'll get to this.
But on the way back, we were down there. So there's me and Betty and another travel companion, and I'd gone for a swim and I was now baking to dry off because it's surprisingly cold, the Colorado. It's, it's snow melt. So it's very cold river and warming off in the sun. And I hear a rustle in the bushes and I think, oh, that's weird. There's no one around. That's really spooky. And I go and it's a well-dressed man. And I, what are you doing, young man? I said in a voice which I must return to my mother. and he sort of said, just, you know, security check. And I'm thinking, well, it's pretty bloody secure. I mean, you know, you, me and the bushes. And all these blacked out Taragos turned up. And Al Gore and his wife and a bunch of security guards. So this was post being vice president, but he still had the full security contingent.
Oh, yeah, they do for life, I think. Yeah.
And then they all got onto rafts and thing. But there was this wonderful moment, like in my, you know, double D 36 bra and panties. And I thought, oh, so I waved and he looked at me like, you know, this is Bill Clinton's sidekick, and he sort of looked for a moment, thought what the protocol was, raised his arm and waved back. I think
excellent.
I'm safe.
You see who you see when you travel across. You never know who you'll run into. Everyone wants to meet the movie stars in LA, but I think that got better. Well, let's fast forward a bit, Sheridan. So, and this is the bit where I want to talk about. So in the middle of it all, you go across the States and you travel over to London for a bit of a side trip that was included in your airfare. And you stay with Mark Colvin, beautiful yeah. Mark Colvin, yeah, yeah, yeah. who died, of course, this year. Everyone knows how devastated we all were. And then you meet someone when you're staying with Mark and his lovely wife, who are good friends of yours. And this is my other point. We always travel when we're heartbroken, and then we always meet someone when they're in the middle of traveling and we can't stick around.
Yeah.
It's freaky.
It was quite early on in the illness, and I'd gone to see Michelle, who's Mark's wife, and just see how they're getting on. You know, it was a big time in their lives. And she was studying philosophy, and she'd just finished her exams, and there was a party on, which I immediately dubbed the Philosopher's Ball because it sounded awfully grand. All these beautiful young men talking from high up their brows. It was a whole lot more Newtown than that, but she introduced me to her friend who was organizing the Philosophical Society. It was this beautiful. I mean, I've never heard of an English rose as a man before. Like, you hear them about women, and I thought, you know, it'd been 18 months since the breakup, and that obviously wasn't going to work. And I thought this was a holiday romance, you know. Yeah. You know, this is great. 10 years younger. I thought, in fact, when I met him, that he was 15 years younger. He looked so, that beautiful English skin. Oh, I was smitten. But it was basically, you know, a couple of days. I was only there for 4 or 5 days. And at the end of it, he drove me to the airport, and I was sort of saying, if I had the money, I would invite you on this road trip, but I don't. He being an independent young man of, you know, not of means, he quit his job, took out a loan, and rang me to say, I'll be there in 5 days. And all I could do was, like, panic, basically, because I was thinking, our third date was effectively going to be 6 weeks in a Chevy Camaro in a tent.
Traveling back from New York to LA.
But also,
like, that's a lot of pressure very early on the casual holiday romance, isn't it?
That's a hell of a third date. You just, oh, no way, no way. So I did something which we all have a bad side. I'd met another man just as an acquaintance who wanted to drive down to New Orleans, who was 10 years older than me, very handsome actor who wanted to go to New Orleans. So I said, look, there's room in the car, you come too. Meanwhile, Sue, so that would have been 4 of us in the car, but Sue, who put up the money for the car, she had a major calamity at home and couldn't come. So she was sort of going, well, this is great, you know, Scott's going to come, and now you've put this other guy, this Matt, into the car. And
you got yourself in a bit of a situation.
I did. But also, I needed a chaperone. I just needed somebody to run Baffle, and they, as it turned out, they shared a love of music. And so we did all the musical ley lines from Washington through the Virginia Mountains, the Blue Ridge Mountains, and then Memphis and Nashville. And
I want you to talk to us about Memphis, because it was just the anniversary recently of Elvis's death,
right.
I think, in a week or two ago. And you went to Graceland and the boys got very emotional.
They did. You know, people surprise me all the time. I thought I was going to see the King of Kitsch. I thought I was going to see Fat Elvis in the white suit and, you know, all the guns and the FBI badges and whatever. And they were going to the heartland of their fathers. They were going to the young men that had raised them and, you know, the blues and the white blues. And Yeah, so I was kind of like in this mood of, you know, let's get to the jungle room. Ooh, it's really wonderful. And there's one room that's like the Moroccan room that has like 15 little tiny televisions in it. And there were TVs everywhere. And you get to the squash courts. I can't have a TV in a squash court, but no, they've got a TV outside.
So it's like TV in nearly all of Elvis's rooms.
Yeah, there's everywhere. Like even the squash courts, there are TVs.
Wow. I don't think he played squash much, but... Because he was watching the telly.
Watching the telly.
Are they in the toilets? Or you're not allowed in
the loo? You're not allowed in the loo, No, you're not. But so there was a moment at the end where I've forgotten the song. Yes, Scott would know. But at the graves, and the graves are there, and they've got the eternal flame. And his grave has a poem on it that his father has written, maybe the colonel. And it's got a trademark symbol on it. And I found this both confronting and amusing. And as I tried to tell everybody, I'm looking at them and they have tears streaming down their face. And I realize I'm ruining something for them. So, yeah, we let that moment slide for a moment.
Well, I think, people go, to Graceland for lots of different reasons, but it is a holy place, obviously.
It is a holy place. Yeah.
And must be included in a road trip across the US.
And in fact, we did make a connection there just while we were waiting for the truck to take us across, because one of the things about friendship as well as adventure is sometimes you meet people on the heartland, and I had been struggling for a long time with IVF. It hadn't been working. I'd done numerous attempts, and it was part of what had eroded the relationship was the lack of intimacy that comes from it. And it turned out that this other man, this Matt, was traveling as well because he'd had trouble with fertility and was at a crossroads in his relationship. And in that moment, so at Graceland, there was a real revelation of the three of us that actually sealed the friendship in a very deep and meaningful way. So the adventure of Graceland had actually started with real grace, and it was just me being childish that kind of muddied that.
Mm. You do have peculiar and intimate relationships on the road. Like it builds up very special friendships, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It really does. And you offer your heart in a way, and it keeps getting blown up. Your timing's a bit out in this relationship on this road trip. But it works in the end, doesn't it? You know, you let the road of freedom take your hearts along with it as well. But you were camping a lot. You know, I've never camped in the US, and I've got to say you have some moments when you're camping. But if anyone has traveled across the US or has some thoughts about why you always fall in love when you're about to travel or when you travel with a broken heart, I would like to take a couple of calls on this. We're talking about road trips. Sheridan Jobbins is with me. Her book is called Wish You Were Here, and the number is 1300 222 702, if you'd like to give us a call. 1300 800 222, and the text line 0467 922 702. What is the place that you keep when you think back through this time and when you were writing that kept coming back to you, that really captured your imagination, that you still see?
As in of the trip? There's a moment on the Mississippi when we're camping. I hadn't heard of Van Morrison. I don't know how I managed to miss him, but it was Poetic Champions Compose, and it's playing softly. Matt's gone to sleep, so it's just Scott and I. And he was telling me about this is so stupid. He was telling me about I've forgotten, O-level. So, because he's British.
Oh, exams in Britain, yeah.
In Britain. He'd done O-level geology, and his parents had taken him to a Swiss glacier, and he was describing the light inside the glacier that was large enough to have a Christmas tree, and the way the light came through it, and it was blue and green. And that beautiful sound, that rough sound of Van Morrison's voice, and the crickets and the frogs and the sound of the burbling river going down. And there's a word in Welsh which is hyraeth, which means the longing for something that doesn't exist, homesick for something that doesn't exist. And all of that is captured in this one sort of moment of listening to it all, and just the idea that O-level geography or geology could even be that romantic is part of what amused me, because it was just so unlikely. Yeah. But his passion for the moment is so encapsulated. And because I'd worked a lot as on television and as a filmmaker, I hadn't wanted to take any cameras or recording equipment. I wanted to use paper maps, and I wanted to do it all like off grid. Even before off grid, I'd wanted to do it that way. And he liked sound very much and wanted, if not to take photographs, to record sound. And I wouldn't let him do that because it felt like bad filmmaking. And he'd come up with this idea to make a mnemonic tape. So basically to stop when moments were shared and to just be in that moment. And I've forgotten the number. There was a whole range of stories that went with it. But that moment is so purely captured by the mnemonic that of all of them, it's the one that's whole.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because everybody takes photos all the time, you know, and people, tourists keep dying because they step off cliffs while they're taking selfies and things. And we have to capture every moment of our trip so we remember it.
Yeah.
But do you remember this trip differently? Because you weren't focusing on taking photos and you were focusing very much on collecting, soundtracks along the way.
Yeah. The idea of the mnemonics is not just the sound, it's also the smell and the light and the color. It's the synesthesia of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes them even more potent. In filmmaking, you'll often stop for a minute at the end of a scene and do a silent recording. So it's the sound of the room, basically, and it helps the editor when they're cutting dialogue so that you don't get blank gaps. And I've always loved that moment because you often have as many as 100, 120 people standing in a space for a moment of just silence. And what comes with it is the sound of their breaths. Some people you can feel are worrying about something, about what they've done or what they will do. But there's a communion in it that is really beautiful. And I found that with these mnemonics. I think there were about 30 in all in the end. And each one of them, if you mention them, like we wrote them down at the end of the trip, and so there's like a tape that says what the numbers were and where they were, and they've got funny names like Historic Marker or Mississippi River Frogs.
Yeah.
And they seem more whole. The first one was at I think it's Jefferson Memorial, and when I say it, I can hear the cicadas. I can hear other people crunching on the white
rocks. It sounds
so
powerful. Because when I think of cicadas, I think of a beach house up the north coast of New South Wales or something, and I'm instantly there.
Yeah.
Or back to my childhood tree where I used to try and collect the black ones, the black prints. They were the most rare, weren't they? And you were desperate to try and find them. So, as you mentioned, you've worked in film a lot, and you worked on Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. So were you on a road trip when you were filming that road trip of the drag queens going across Australia?
I didn't have much to do with the production of that. At the time, I was running the company with Rebel Penfold Russell, but Stefan and I subsequently became very close friends. Working together out of London for a short while. I moved there with my plot spoiler husband. So we've been working together for about 17 years. So, yes. So, no, I wasn't on a road trip on that one, but I've always loved the road trip.
It's a great, it's just a fantastic story for film. You mentioned Thelma and Louise.
Yeah. But also, I mean, it is one of the great road trips, Priscilla, and another film that stands up very well. I saw it quite recently. They did a...
Well, they're doing a musical out of it.
Oh, yeah.
Won't that be fun?
Oh, no, they've done that a while. It's coming back.
It's coming back though, the new one. So it's so good, it keeps coming back again.
And it is. It's a really feel-good musical. Yeah.
And what about in terms of, I mean, it's interesting because you're a filmmaker and you've written this lovely book and it's very funny and you really take us there to so many moments. What's the difference in terms of storytelling for writing and for where you're on your own? Where, as opposed to film, when you're working with a team and for something people are going to see and experience rather than read individually.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of pronounced differences. I'm very lucky to work in a partnership with Stefan because he's very talented and he's hilarious. So working with another writer.
You must have laughed the whole time.
Just hilarious. Sometimes we've shared an office before with my husband and he says we often talk to each other while typing. So I have one keyboard and we'll be doing edits and stuff. And all he hears is tap, 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 and then roars of laughter. And it's like, what are you doing in there? And often Stefan will be writing dialogue and there'll be a joke planted in it. There are a number of differences. One is that film writing is a show, not a tell. So everything's in the present. In memoir and in most fiction writing, it's in the past tense. So that tense thing is kind of difficult. One of the big differences. Oh no, there's a number. Another one is you can do interior dialogue in memoir, which and in fiction, which you can't do in screenwriting because you need to show and tell everything, and it needs to come out in an organic fashion. But the biggest shock for me was that a film script's about 20,000 words, and a book is about 100 to 120, and I got about 2/3 of the way, about 60,000 in, and I'm thinking,
I'm done.
This is never going to end. It's so long, and you have to do all the stuff. Like, there's all this shorthand in film. You go interior, blah blah, and you've got all these little bar lines that says he says, she says, and you don't have to say he said meaningfully. You know, you almost never do that. So
the mechanics of it very different in terms of writing. You've got to be more patient.
Yeah, much more patient. And there was one thing that I struggled with as memoir and also as a former journalist, which is in screenwriting, you do a dialogue and you kind of get the voice and the slangy bit to try and make the character come alive. When you're doing memoir, if you put it into quotes, you're then quoting people. And of course, I'm not quoting people. I don't remember what they said in the moment. I just remember what they meant or what was conveyed to me. And I found that very confronting. Particularly that I was putting words into people's mouths that they might not approve of, or they might have wanted nuanced differently.
Because they're real people as well, not ones you've created and just, you know, made yourself and constructed.
Yeah, and also they're people whose opinion I care about. Yeah. Like, you know, I don't know how many there are in your world, but maybe 20 people, their opinion I care about, at least 12 of them are in the book.
Yeah. Well, it must have been fun to write it though. And because you have more control, I'm imagining, when you're on your own and you're writing a book, as opposed to a film, you've got to think about who's going to perform it and the producer
and what's been commissioned and what they want.
Yeah.
And, there's something nice about it coming from your own experience too, because you've got the records to draw on, the diaries or the photographs such as they were. But also it's in your own head. It's your own perspective. You are the camera in that moment, and I liked that.
Yeah, I bet. And what are you working on now, Sheridan?
This is fresh. Yeah. So,
What are you going to do next, I should say?
You know, I'm really tempted. 2 years ago, my mum, who's 90th. Oh my God, she's so old. She's fantastic. She works 4 days a week with a charity. She's just a terrific woman. Anyway, I've been to her birthday party today. But 2 years ago in Berlin, she was visiting a girlfriend, who's German, and they had discovered that they were the same age and that they'd had a very similar experience of life, except for one thing, that during their teenage years they had been enemies. And her friend was very familiar with Australia and lives here and knows her world, and invited her to Germany to see her world and to show her that they were no longer enemies and that the Germans are beautiful people. So Mum accepted this invitation and went. But on the fourth day, seriously broke her ankle, like almost screwed her foot off, and spent 6 weeks in an East Berlin hospital. I'm tempted to say jail, but it was a hospital. It was an absolutely earth-shattering experience for both of us because of her age and because of her experiences growing up, and the fact that the rape of Berlin, this story doesn't sound like much fun, does it? It was actually fantastic, but it was a very intense family experience. And the only book I had to read while doing it, a friend who's a scriptwriter in Germany, he had one English language book, which was How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. And so I'm going through this experience with my mother, and every day I'm doing these little stand-up comedy routines that I'm doing from this book, like How to Be a Stand-Up Comic.
Are you going to be a stand-up comic next?
No. It's just a delicious distraction from trying to, you know, not have a foot chopped off.
Yeah.
There's something about all this that ties in with stumble stones and family history and the black humor of being. But as you get older and as your parents become entwined into your daily care, I think there's something in there that's, if I was pitching Wish You Were Here, I don't think it would sound as funny as this was. But I also had my poodle with me, so that there was like this other, like there's Betty, there's Pamela, the spoodle, who's kind of like
the also, other character.
Yeah, yeah, for 6 weeks requires attention.
Well, poodles are pretty neurotic, so.
You're telling me.
They?
Like their owners, I'm afraid.
You are like your dog, you think, right?
Yeah. She's my little familiar.
Your dogs become like you. Oh, well, it's a terrific read and I really, really enjoyed it. And I still want to travel across America, even if there isn't really a Route 66 like you think there is, because
there is. It runs parallel and it's kind of an imagination. It's an ideal of America that still exists.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, a lot of it is in here, you take some great journeys and really bring it to us. So I hope it goes really well. You're in Australia at the moment, but you live in Switzerland now. How amazing is that?
Yeah, it is. It's extraordinary. A woman who loves the sea is landlocked. but what a place to be with the CERN and with the Red Cross. And there's just an incredible society of people who are trying to save the world and trying to do good. It's a terrific place.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming in. I'm going to play a road trip car and then we're going to go on a road trip with Russell Broadbent pretty soon on the show. He is somewhere in Australia. We'll find out where he is and what he's doing after this. It's Tracy Chapman and Fast Car, and Sheridan Jobbins has been my guest. Her book is called Wish You Were Here.